Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Salutations, ladies, gentlemen, and anybody else of any gender specificity. This is the Media Dungeon. I'm Comrade Britt.
And I am Patrick.
Welcome. Today we are here to talk about Dune. And I know what you must be saying, longtime listeners. Hey, you two have already reviewed Dune from 1984. Guess what? We're here to review Dune from 2021 and Dune 2 from 2024.
Absolutely.
Before we get into that, though, let's talk quickly about our Patreon. We would appreciate it if you checked out our Patreon, if you're not already listening on Patreon. Help support us, helps keep us pumping out tons of podcasts. There's other podcasts on the Dumb Idiot Bullshit Podcast Network on which we're on, including Soy Trek. We've got Getting Head, a Bucket Cast. We've got Prison Breakdown. We've got Dumb Idiot Bullshit. And of course, we have the Media Dungeon, which is where we are now.
Mm-hmm. We are currently residents inside the dungeon. We are locked up on the wall. Like the prisoners in Wizard of Id.
Yeah, yeah. I feel more like Slaughterhouse 5, where I'm just like being observed. But that's probably because I keep my windows open at all hours and do weird things in them.
You do, yeah. When we record over there, I would just like look over and yeah, there would be just a person across the way just staring directly into your apartment, just watching this podcast.
Staring back while slowly stroking the windows.
Doing that slow jerk.
Yeah. So, should we talk about the background of this movie at all, I guess? Would that be helpful?
Yeah. I think that would suffice.
Yeah. Dune, if you don't know, is a book. This isn't based on the movie, although the first Dune movie has a lot of similarities. It's sometimes beat for beat with David Lynch's 1984 adaptation of Dune. This is actually the third adaptation of Dune following David Lynch's 1984 film and John Harrison's 2000 television miniseries, which I don't know if you've seen. I've watched a bit of it. It's all right.
Yeah, I watched the sci-fi series that has James McAvoy finally saying his name correctly, who plays Leto the Second.
So after an unsuccessful attempt by Paramount Pictures to produce a new adaptation of the film, Legendary Pictures acquired the Dune film and television rights in 2016, with Denis Villeneuve signing on as director in February 2017. Production contracts were secured only for the first film, relying on its success before a sequel would be produced. So... which is a pretty big bet and kind of interesting that they did that. But, you know, it's a Denis Villeneuve film. He's like, you know, like in, he did Blade Runner 2024 and also Arrival. And so he's proven his worth, especially at doing adapted material.
Oh, yeah. Arrival, I think, is probably one of my favorite sci-fi movies I've ever seen.
I watched it again a couple weeks ago, and, like, even though you know the ending, it, like, comes up on you like a wave at the end.
Yeah.
And it wrecks you, man. It's an emotionally, like, intense film, and it's about, like, linguistics and science, but also, like, love and loss, and it's just, like, a beautiful fucking sci-fi film. It's really fucking cool and interesting.
A sci-fi movie that's a secret weepy. That's what I always call it. It's like,
and of course we have, we also have Blade Runner 2049, which he did, which also a wonderful adaptation of an original work and also a sequel. What do you think of that film?
I loved it. Like, when I first saw it, though, I saw it in theaters, and I saw it next to it. It was this really annoying guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I was just, like, it was really marring, like, my enjoyment of the film. Mm-hmm. But then when I was able to, like, you know, go home and watch it on my own in a nice, quiet area, like, I enjoyed it a lot more, because that way, I love 2049. I think it was, like, the only thing I would have changed, is I would have probably left Harrison Ford out of it. I think he
was probably fine. Did. It was serviceable, and it made sense to the story, I think.
Yeah, I probably could have used it without him, though.
Yeah, but, I mean, I don't know. I feel like it could have been just more of a futuristic drive without Harrison Ford's involvement.
That's true.
Like a passing of the torch kind of thing, and like an old man who is like seeing life, or an old maybe replicant, or definitely replicant. I don't remember where it fell on that. He was a replicant, right? Everyone was a replicant.
And 2049?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It took away any ambiguity right from the beginning that, like he's a replicant and he has a digital waifu that he has that appears to him that he can't have sex with.
We love this.
Unless she's superimposed on top of another replicant, and then he can have sex with her.
Yeah, I need to go back and watch that. Good film.
That's really good.
So, interestingly, this film was all principal photography took place in 2019, and effects were done by 2020. It was scheduled for a late 2020 release, but was delayed due to COVID-19, like many things. So instead, it ended up getting released worldwide on October 22nd, 2021.
Yeah, they released it directly to HBO Max.
They did, which is interesting.
Yeah, very strange. Like, but that's how I was able to like watch it like five times right after another. Like when it first came out, I was just like, cool, I'm gonna watch it again. And I think I watched it like 5 days in a row almost. It was crazy.
Yeah. Denis Villeneuve directed this film. He's also co-writer producer on this project. He co-wrote the script with a couple of guys named John Spahates and Eric Roth. John Spahates is best known for doing the screenplays of Prometheus, Passengers, and Doctor Strange. Passengers is pretty ill-received. I watched it and hated it.
Yeah, I didn't. What was the first one?
Prometheus.
I didn't really like Prometheus either.
All right.
that one was just confounding to me.
Yeah. And then I just didn't see Doctor Strange. But then Eric Roth, the other guy who helped him adapt this, has been nominated 6 times for adapted screenplay, including Forrest Gump, The Insider, Munich, Curious Case of Benjamin Button, A Star is Born, and Dune. This one, winning once for Gump. And he was also recently included on Killers of the Flower Moon.
And oh, so wow.
This guy is like a powerhouse writer, especially
for
adapted works. So the cinematographer is Greg Fraser, best known for the cinematography of Zero Dark Thirty, Rogue One, and Vice. So he's been around. Joe Walker is the editor, who is a longtime collaborator with Denis Villeneuve, including Sicario, every single one of his films since Sicario, He's also worked with Steve McQueen on four of his films, including 12 Years a Slave. So he's a very, very, very in-demand editor.
Yeah, Sicario is another real movie I like by him that is amazing. Like, that one gave me anxiety watching that movie.
So, Dune. Yeah, a little history about it. It's a big book that was released in what, the 60s, 1965, I think.
Yeah, yeah, pretty back there.
Yeah, it's I read it when I was in middle high school on like an assignment for like a book report type thing. When did you first read Dune?
I think it was pretty early on. My dad was obsessed with Dune. Like, he showed me the 1984 Dune when I was very young. And he only had the first Dune book. I ended up rereading it, and then like I pretty much read all the books, all the Frank Herbert books, pretty fast. Like, when I was a door guy, like, I just sat there and I just like powered through like all the books. And
hell yeah.
Yeah, got all my Dune knowledge. But I love the books. The books are great.
I only made it up to, I think, the third one, God Emperor of Dune, I want to say. Is that the third one?
I think so, probably. Yeah. I don't know. I can't remember. There's Dune Messiah, I think, is coming next.
I actually read them out of order. I read Dune Messiah third, and then I think it was Children of Dune is the third one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I read, I think, Children of Dune after Dune and was kind of confused. Although I'm like,
that makes sense, because that's when Leto II gets covered in the worms.
Yeah, yeah. So I was, a little confused there. But I read them like way back in the day. Yeah, I had definitely a Dune era when I was like 17 or 18. So I don't really remember a whole lot of everything, except like I remembered like the still suits were like vivid in my memory. And like, you know, obviously like the Shai Hulud, although they never really even say Shai Hulud in the film. They do like a couple times, but not much.
Yeah. Not enough. I feel they should be.
Yeah. Yeah. They mostly just call them like the worms or the sandworms.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's an awesome, awesome band called Shai Hulud. Mm-hmm. The movie is like this, or sorry, the movie, the book is like, it's about like histories, languages, resource acquisition, power structures, and maybe most importantly, like faith. And it's like,
and this clones.
Yeah. And it's like a deep, deep meditations on a lot of these things. And a lot of it like comes through in dreams, and then also like inner dialogue, mostly between like, especially in the first book, I remember there being a lot of inner dialogue for Paul, a lot for Lady Jessica, and a lot for Baron Harkonnen, which is like really absent from this film. But, you know, I think a lot of that would have been a lot more difficult to translate.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they kind of do like kind of voiceovers in the 1984 Dune, and whenever he sees like, the Gamjabar. Kill me, type stuff. And just like, just have to have like Paul's inner thoughts projected to the audience. And this, I feel like, the new Dunes, I feel they do a much better job of translating a lot of like subtle stuff much better to the audience. Like, you know, and even though in this one, I feel like the first one, a little bit more subtle. This is more like, you know, in your face. Like, especially, you know, like the Lisa Nagib, you know, type stuff.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot more. But at the same time, I feel like it's a little more powerful because of that. And I feel like it's almost a better adaptation because of that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, I feel
very in your face and like not necessarily nuanced, I don't think. Or as nuanced as like David Lynch made his movie.
Yeah.
And
I feel like there was a more of like, you know, taking the entire history of Dune into perspective and like developing the world as it would naturally like progress in that sort of like confines of like rejecting all thinking machines. Because like, you know, and this, I feel like it shows that they have a much more minimalist sort of like aesthetic where there's not like machine, you know, to other sci-fi properties you see like a lot of mundane stuff is like relegated to machines and in Star Trek, you know, famously, like, there's the computer that they all instantly ask a question to. And here it's just like, you know, they've had to create mentats, you know, people who can calculate large numbers in their heads and as fast as a computer, and just like human excellence has had to like be ramped up in order to compensate for the lack of machines. And, and it shows like also like, yeah, there's like, we, like typically where you would see lots of machines, you just see like just plain minimalist architecture and stuff like that, which is pretty cool.
Yeah. And that I guess is some pretty good background for like this film and the story in general. Is like, okay, there's no real like computers. They were wiped out in like 2,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Was that the Butlerian Jihad? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So that was like a long time ago that happened. They don't really mention it. It's just like kind of a fact that you like.
Yeah.
It's one of those great like show don't tell things. Mm-hmm. It's just like everything is very like mechanical and like, you know, not very futuristic technically, but very futuristic in the fact that they do have like faster than light travel. But as you said, they've had to develop these people, mentats, in order to fly their ships faster than light. And
the guild navigators
and they're all addicted to a drug called spice, which allows their brain to like do these calculations and basically see into the future. And so that's kind of the setup for this whole thing. And there's only one planet where they can get this spice.
Yes.
Arrakis. So let's dive into this movie with that background there.
Yeah.
This movie opens on narration, but in a much better way than the 1984 version, where Zendaya explains that the Fremen and their cause against the Harkonnens, who have like been living on their planet for a long time and occupying them. And basically whoever controls the planet controls everything, because it's like, you know, it's more important than like gasoline is to America.
If you think about it, this is just like America going into into the Middle East and taking up all the oil.
Yeah,
and having to
through oil through native lands, you know,
and using like the CIA to use religious fundamentalism to undermine the native population.
this movie is kind of the Southern strategy. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Damn. Mm-hmm.
So right now, the Fremen, the native population on Arrakis, is fighting against the Harkonnens, who are also the richest house in the galaxy. And they got that rich by selling spice, and they currently occupy the planet. So the Harkonnens are told to leave by imperial decree by the Emperor. And the Emperor chooses House Atreides to rule the planet. Mm-hmm. But there's some funny business going on here.
A little bit of funny business.
So we're introduced to Paul Atreides, played by Timothy Chalamet, and Lady Jessica, played by Rebecca Ferguson. And they could be brother and sister here, but they're, you know, it's a kid and his like hot mom.
Yeah, because I think like Rebecca Ferguson's only like, I think, 15 years older than Timothy Chalamet.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's like also, yeah, like the Bene Gesserit are just like, you know, I feel like they're able to, since they have like full control over their bodies and everything else, they can probably
choose to age like Data in
yeah, essentially. Like, but also, I guess it kind of tracks, you know, especially when, you know, we find the Bene Gesserit, you know, just like have been manipulating this one bloodline for, you know, thousands of years. It can make sense, like, you know, once she comes to breeding age, you know, just gotta like pump out the next super child for.
Yeah, you're not wrong. They have great chemistry on screen, though, and that's kind of like the main crux of this film, is the relationship between, as far as relationships go. This is more of a like a plot driven film than character driven film, but If there's two characters this movie is about, it's Lady Jessica and Paul Atreides.
Absolutely, yeah.
Next, we're introduced to Duncan Idaho, played by Jason Momoa, who is perfectly cast in this role. And he's also like a clean-shaven Jason Momoa in a lot of it, which is interesting. Yeah. Paul talks about a dream, which is a big theme in the books and in this movie. And I think it it does a lot better of job of conveying dreams in this film, I think, because it's mostly just Paul talking about dreams instead of like him just having a dream and it just showing it.
And the dreams aren't literal, like it's open to interpretation, like they're like the meaning is kind of obfuscated, like his, you know, dream of Jamis, you know, played by Mbinga, our friend Mbinga. Like like, you know, you're kind of, you know, the dream Jamis is kind of like much different than the reality, where he seems to be like this teacher and who wants to take Paul under his wing and be like a he's more gentle and is, wants to be seen as his mentor than anything else. And but as we see, like, you know, that there's meaning there, and like that meaning is kind of like, you know, the true meaning of the reality of it's much different.
indeed. So next we are introduced to Duke Leto, played by Oscar Isaac, who is just wonderful in everything he's ever been in. He's a great person to cast in your movie.
Yeah, I remember after this movie came out, like the one dude he was in Star Wars with, guy who played Finn, you know, his partner. He was kind of like, he was just like on Twitter, he was just like, "Wow, I wish I was in that, I wish we were in the, I was in that movie."
John Boyega.
John Boyega, yeah, like John Boyega was just like was pretty jealous of the of what they were able to pull off with Dune that they were not able to pull off with, like, what was the last, The Rise of Skywalker or The Rise of...
And although, although the first movie didn't make, like, nearly as much money as any of the Star Wars, like, this one is on track to definitely overtake several Star Wars films.
Oh, yeah.
Dune 2.
Dune 2. Yeah, which that means we're definitely getting the third. Maybe we're going to get a whole Dune series, which would be fantastic.
Sick, actually. That would be so amazing. I mean,
you kind of worry with like how with today's just like and how we how studios just like make films now. Like
it'll end up being like The Hobbit.
Yeah, I'm just hoping it doesn't just get awful. You know, like we're not gonna have like, you know, Ghostbusters, Frozen Empire level type movies, but with Dune. That's what terrifies me.
I haven't heard or seen anything about that movie.
Ugh. I've heard lots. I mean, just looking at it just seems like just a very hollow cash grab type film. And
yeah, a lot of sequels are.
Yeah, so, but that's the thing. That's why I'm hoping, like, that doesn't, you know, become Dune's fate. But if it's controlled by, if it has a singular vision from Dene, like, you know, I think, like, we're in good shape.
Yeah, hopefully.
Hopefully.
So Duke Leto talks to Paul and explains the politics of basically this entire movie in a really well-written and non-clunky way. Good writing here. This is a very solid script, I'll say.
Yeah.
Duke Leto talks about getting desert power. Which sounds pretty cool to me.
Getting desert power.
Desert power, yeah.
Yeah, because they're able to they're able to cultivate, you know, sea power, I think he says. Or
they live in like a Scotland like world, basically.
Actually, and you know, Frank Herbert actually lived in like the peninsula in Washington. Like he lived in like Port Townsend.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And so like they think like that's where a lot of the inspiration for Caladan came from, was his time there, because you're on the there's lots of cliffs, lots of oceans, you can see the water everywhere. So I could see like Frank Herbert being very inspired by that sort of like environment.
No, Yeah. To me, it looked a lot more like Scotland, especially since later they have bagpipes, but we'll talk about
that. Yeah, they do. Which is weird because, like, in the books, they talk about how the Atreides have, like, lineage that traces back to, like, I think, like, Greece and stuff. And in here, they obviously have some Spanish influence as well because, like, they mention how Paul's grandfather was killed in a bullfight. But you kind of see, I mean, this is like taking place in like the year 10,000 something, so it's just like pretty much all cultures have just been like molded into like these separate houses, so it tracks
for sure. So next we're introduced to Josh Brolin is Gurney Halleck, taking the mantle from Patrick Stewart in the 1984 film.
Sadly he does do a better job. Like, I don't know if you saw that quote from Patrick Stewart's time on Dune, 1984. I guess like when he was hired for the 1984 Dune, I guess David Lynch was under had only seen him in some play where he was wearing a wig, so it was under the impression that he had full hair and a beard. Then he showed up completely bald, and I guess it pissed him off. And so Patrick Stewart claims David Lynch didn't say a single word to him on his entire time on Dune.
What?
Like, didn't give him any direction. So like, and I guess Patrick Stewart obviously hadn't read the books or anything. So. That may clue you into like his performance in that film. Let's just say,
I actually like Patrick Stewart a lot in that film.
And yeah,
I think the film's pretty fun, and it's a decent adaptation. It's just like not nearly as good as Dune 1 and 2.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, he does do like very subtle things, like things I thought of, like how like you know he goes into battle with like the Atreides pug, and like And someone brought up a good point, like, oh, you know, that just makes sense. Like, in his mind, all the Atreides have just died. Mm-hmm. And, like, and so, and the last thing he has is this pug. That's, like, it's, like, the last thing that's the last symbol of the Atreides is, like, their precious pugs. And he's sworn to protect it even going into battle. So I think that makes sense. Like, I like that.
We love that. So Gurney Halleck does a shielded knife fight with Paul, and this scene is maybe the only scene I actually really prefer the 1984 version of.
Interesting.
Yeah, the 1984 version, it has like these weird old effects, but I think like it's just as effective, if not more so, than this. And I really like Patrick Stewart's performance in it. He yells at Paul about how he needs to toughen up.
Yeah.
So
he's nut up or shut up.
Yeah. Next, we get a great scene, and we're introduced to House Harkonnen, specifically Rabban Harkonnen, played wonderfully by Dave Bautista of wrestling fame. And the absolute force in this film and in number two that is Stellan Skarsgård playing, who's the patriarch of the Skarsgård family, playing the patriarch of the Harkonnen family, Baron Harkonnen. These two, actually everyone with the last name Harkonnen has my favorite performance in these films. These two guys, and then Austin Butler in the next film, put in some incredible, weird, and great work. And they make a lot of decisions, all of which I think are perfect and villainous and wonderful.
Oh, yeah. And I definitely like the look of all of them where, they're completely hairless.
And, like, completely white because they live on a planet with a black sun. But that's on the second film, and it's so fucking cool.
That was one of the sickest effects I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Like, they look incredible. Like, you know, in David Lynch's Dune, they all have, like, red hair, clear. And this, I they look much more menacing. The color alien and just sort of, like, gross and greasy type weird people.
they're disgusting. We love that.
Yeah.
So we're now introduced to the Bene Gesserit, a sect of religious women with mystical powers. We're also introduced to the Reverend Mother, the leader of this sect, whose aim is total religious control of the galaxy, but through like shadow policy, basically.
And we get to make the Kwasat Haderach and control him, have like a leash on him.
Yeah, exactly. So now we get the box scene, which I think is wonderful in the 1984 version and extra wonderful in this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like a really powerful scene that like shows us like the weird cunning and deception of this religious order and like how far they're willing to go to like get power.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty fun.
Yeah, they're testing him to see if he's like if Jessica had brought forth the Kwasatz Haderach a generation early, because like how they had intended it was supposed to be like Jessica was supposed to give a girl child that was supposed to like right. Supposed to breed with Fade, yeah. That would make the Kwasatz Haderach, but mm-hmm. due to Jessica's love for Leto, like she decided to give him a male heir,
mm-hmm.
and sort of like disrupt their kind of whole plans and everything, and so yeah, the mother's got to like test him to see if he's like, you know, see his worth. See if
right,
he's
right.
Like...
So he puts his hand in the box, and he doesn't last 5 minutes. He comes.
How long will you last?
Yeah,
playing this game. You won't last 5 minutes. You're gonna come.
Yeah, and so he comes, but he doesn't die. She's like, "All right, you passed the test.
You're the first
hasty,
the first man to come without dying."
So, actually, she's like, "That wasn't a test. I just wanted to see you come. It's cool."
Yeah.
Late. So
you canceled, Reverend Mother. You canceled.
So the Atreides make their way to Arrakis and take over. And for some reason, they have bagpipes when they exit their ship.
Which is sick. Like, I loved how, like, then the bagpipes go into the, like, the score of the film, like it just starts with him playing and then plays like the song. I like the song sick, and we get like a reprise of that song later, like during the fight, and yeah. It's incredible.
Yeah, we didn't even mention. Sorry, I didn't even mention who did the music on here. It's Hans Zimmer.
On
both of these movies, and he actually turned down. Christopher Nolan asked him to do the score for Tenet, and he turned it down, citing his love for the book Dune.
And I think that's a good decision, because Tenet is a very divisive film,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't particularly enjoy watching it myself, and mm-hmm. I feel like a Hans Zimmer score would have just been lost in that film, because, I mean, the defenders you really see for that are just, like, the absolute, like, weirdest online weirdos sometimes. Like, it was, like, wasn't a film that I particularly enjoyed at all, and I think he made a much more memorable score for the Dune films, and yeah, he also had fun doing it. Like, I don't know if you saw that video of him playing like the Dune theme with a live band, and he's just like rocking out. Like he just loves it, and so it's just like, oh yeah, this is what this dude wants, not some shitty score for a crappy film.
So we meet Stephen McKinley Henderson as Thufir Hawat, who's always a joy to see in anything he's in.
And, yeah, he's been in lots of really good sci-fi stuff. Like, I don't know if you watched the limited series Devs that was on Hulu.
No, I've heard that's good.
Oh, that was sick! Like, check that out. Like, he makes an appearance in that, and yeah, he appears in lots of stuff. He was also in Beau's Afraid, I think.
Yeah. It's strange, though, because he was kind of unexpectedly removed from Dune 2, whereas his character is, like, a part of the story all the way through the novel.
Yeah, I mean, we don't get a cat-milking scene with him in Dune 2, unfortunately.
So, yeah, that's...
Like, we don't get to see him, like, have to milk a cat to survive, which is, like... Which is also, it's like you know, just something added by David Lynch, but... Also, I think he was, like, cut for time, because, yeah, there was so much other stuff to cover, like... We probably didn't need to cover, like, Thufir's, like, torture and stuff by the Harkonnens. Like, that would have been too much. So, and probably an unnecessary, kind of, because, like, we establish how cruel the Harkonnens are without having a Thufir torture scene, so.
True.
Mm-hmm.
So we get a long landscape shot of Arrakis that gives us a sense of the scale of the entire planet, and it's just, like, enormous. Really great use of CGI here for world building, which I'd say pretty much about both films in their entirety. Like, CGI is complementary and not central focus, and it's present in probably every single scene, but it's not distracting.
No.
Yeah.
No, like, it's nothing, it's not like, you know, a lot of films now where you have just, like the backgrounds, all the creatures you interact with are just CGI.
Like Little Moon, like,
yeah,
watch that one, and like that one was all CGI, and it like detracted so much from the film.
Yeah, like you could tell, like, you know, obviously they'd be, you know, like they were actually on physical sets and locations in some desert area and able to have those establishing shots that make it seem like they're on a planet that's nothing but a giant desert, but. Mm-hmm. It's great because, like, yeah, but like everything feels physical. Everything feels like it has weight. Like, it feels like characters and inside an actual universe and not just CGI'd against a green screen.
Yeah,
which I really appreciate.
I appreciate that as well. It's it makes for like a much more engaging experience. You can tell like the actors are actually engaged in this, which is nice. Mm-hmm. So, we get a scene where the Reverend Mother and Baron Harkonnen conspire against House Atreides. He agrees not to kill Paul or Lady Jessica. And after the Reverend Mother leaves, he's like, I agreed not to kill them, but we'll leave them to the desert, basically.
Yeah, she's like basic, and he doesn't even have that cone of silence around them anymore. She's just like, the moment she gets out the door, he's just like, these are my true plans. You know, just like within hearing distance. It's like,
oh, that goes a lot in here. Shit.
Yeah. What the hell?
So next we're introduced to Stilgar, played by Javier Bardem, who does an excellent job in both of these films. He's not very central to the first film, but he becomes very central to the second film.
Yeah, is introducing him, but he does a great, you know, I liked, you know, what's his face in 1984 Dune, but I do like the move, like, that's one thing I liked, like, you know, in the 1984 Dune, all the Fremen are white people. Yeah. just like entirely white people. And I do like how they made them more diverse, and even like their language I read is mostly like it's like the Fremen language is like a mixture of like different Arab dialects. There's also some Mediterranean in there. It's just like there's a whole bunch of different stuff in there, and it's just great to see that attention to detail. And yeah, got to see, like, yeah, them actually depicted as they're supposed to be, like, non-white people.
Yeah, they're kind of, you know, they're people of the sand, and there's like not a sand environment that like white people live in except for Arizona.
No, yeah. Or like, yeah, or if they've colonized the place, like, you know, Israel.
True.
Just like, true. Like, we have, you know, Michael Rapaport, you know, saying he's indigenous to the Middle East, and he's like one of the most pale, pasty, worm people that we've ever seen.
Stilgar is a leader of the Fremen, and he tells them that all the Fremen want is for everybody to leave the desert forever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that makes sense. So next we're introduced to Sharon Duncan Brewster as Dr. Liet Kanes, who is accepted by the Fremen, and she shows Paul and Duke Leto spice harvesting when something goes wrong and they have to save the day. This is a pretty fun action scene right here. I really like this. It was pretty tense. Mm-hmm. Paul gets a big whiff of spice and hears a bunch of voices and shit. And then we get a sandworm eating an entire fucking, like, spice harvesting ship. It's, like, huge. It's, like...
It's a grandfather worm.
Yeah, yeah, and it's sick as fuck. Like, the worms in this film, like, they have this sense of scale that's just, like, enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty sick.
That's what I'm saying, like, when I was a kid, like, I always... That's one thing I always heavily associate with Dune is it's like, that's the worm book. You know, just books just with, like, just worms all on them. And I was really interested in it. But, yeah, it's great. Like, you know, we got our Shai Hulud's, you know, the... And I think, like, in that scene, like, I think it is, like, Paul who kind of, like, is there a connection between, like, the worms and the spice? Because I don't think that's like entirely known yet about the worm's relation to the spice. So, and that, you know, I think it's something that Fremen know, but like something that's kind of like kept secret to the world at large.
Indeed.
So, House Harkonnen attacks the planet at night in a coup. And this was like kind of the whole plan all along. This is sick as fuck. There's a bunch of great battle scenes here. They capture Lady Jessica and Paul, and they wound Duke Leto, and he gets a fake poison tooth from Dr. Wellington, played by Chang Chen. Duncan Idaho does a bunch of killing. He just like starts murking everyone everywhere, and it's really fucking sick. He just kills so many Harkonnens. blows a fuck ton of shit up. It's
in the Sardaukar.
Yeah, it's really fucking sick, dude. so we have a scene where Paul learns how to use the voice, and Lady Jessica uses it to kill some dudes, but in doing so, they are stranded in the desert. And this scene was so fucking sick.
Oh, yeah.
Lady Jessica was like, kill that guy. And it basically, like, using the force, like, dark force powers. But, like, well before. I mean, this was made well before fucking.
Also, one thing I love about that scene is, like, they send, like, a deaf Harkonnen. Because, like a deaf person is obviously, like, saved from the Bene Gesserit voice powers. And it's just like, well, why don't you send all deaf people?
That's true.
like they only said like one guy, and it's just like, well,
why don't you give everyone like soundproof headphones or some shit?
Yeah, soundproof headphones. You can't do shit. Like, just like give them some earbuds or give them some like, you know, skull some, candy type shit.
Ray buds? What are the
ones? Yeah, just give them some sick ass headphones. They'll let them listen to their favorite music, and then like and like Lady Jessica's just like anybody else. You can just like put a bullet in her head.
What would happen if you made a recording of the voice and played it back to someone?
That's a good question. Could you just have it like just always like that's one thing the Bene Gesserit could do. They could make recordings give me the money.
If Bene Gesserit did like jerk off instruction videos,
Could
make so much goddamn money. You have no idea.
It would just make anybody.
People
could be a weapon.
Can be coming. Yeah, like fucking. Yeah, they could.
That's what
that shit.
Yeah, they like when all the Sardaukar and Harkonnen were like attacking Arrakeen, like the base, and to kill the Atreides, like they could have just had like a recording of the Bene Gesserit doing a J.O. instruction, and so then like they'd be like, "No, I'm compelled to stop fighting and start jerking off.
Get the dickless soldiers. They will survive."
Oh no, they're sending stuff up their ass. They're massaging the prostate.
They look behind them. We're talking about Lady Jessica and Paul here. And they see a wrecked city, and everyone they know is dead, basically. Next, we get this scene between like Baron Harkonnen, Duke Leto, and Dr. Wellington, where Baron Harkonnen is like wounded and like naked in this. They have like this big palatial kind of like a banquet room, and they're both sitting on ends of like a very long table. And Duke Leto still has like the poison tooth in his mouth that can kill like a bunch of people in the same room. So Dr. Wellington reveals that he is the one who sold out Duke Leto and the whole house Atreides, and Baron Harkonnen slits his throat for the favor.
He wants to go back to his wife, because like Baron has his wife. Which did you see? Like there was like speculation online that Dr. Yue's wife was actually that spider creature.
I didn't see speculation. That's an interesting thought, though, because there is on the Harkonnen home planet or something, like it shows just briefly like this spider type humanoid creature, and you wonder like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
And then, like, nobody really explains it at all.
People were, because like in the Dune universe, they haven't been introduced yet, but there's like this other group of people called the Talaxu, who are just like these little tiny guys who have like reptilian metallic skin, and they are they're known for like gene manipulation and just like and doing weird experiments, and they make themselves into like what their perfect idea of a human being is, which is like this tiny reptilian dude, and they mm-hmm. pretty much just clone themselves. So, and like that spider creature seemed like it to be a Talaxu like creation, you know, just kind of like, you know, this like thing that's been like modified to look that way. But who knows? But I mean, it's fun to think about that was Dr. Yue's wife, but, you know, who knows? Like, we never find out. she supposedly just died. She was killed.
Yeah. She was killed, apparently.
Yeah.
We'll take Baron Harkonnen's word for it.
The liar and the thief.
Yeah. Activates the poison tooth and kills a bunch of Harkonnens, but not Baron Harkonnen. He flies up to the ceiling because somehow he has floating powers. And, they're sick.
He's got those modifications. Yeah, like his spine seems to have like a levitation thing in it, and since his body is too bulbous, like that's how he transports himself. But and one thing I liked about that is like you see this sort of the consequences of this carry on to the second film, and every time we see Baron Harkonnen in the second film, he's always either submerged in the goo. Mm-hmm. Or has like a floating respiratory system with him,
right?
At all times,
he's also submerged in the goo or like in a hot tub for like pretty much the rest of this film as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Just like getting that life saving goo.
Yeah. So Paul gets high as fuck on spice and has a vision where he and Zendaya are leading a holy war in his name, and he freaks out about it. I too
understand
Zendaya, but not now. We do lead a holy war of sorts.
Yeah.
Duncan Idaho finds Paul and Lady Jessica in the desert and tells them that the Harkonnens took over the entire planet. So they take them to the only place that they'll be safe. The motherfucking Fremen.
The Fremen.
Dr. Keynes is there and tells them that basically the Fremen want a verdant planet, but spice production is too important to the rest of the galaxy. And basically has made it a desert planet in order to create spice.
Because like originally, like the plan was to terraform it and make it into a green place until like they're like, oh shit, this space cocaine is out of control. We gotta have it.
So they talk about a Bene Gesserit prophecy where the first boy Bene Gesserit is gonna lead a holy war and lead the galaxy, and moreover, the Fremen, into paradise. Duncan Idaho sacrifices himself, but kills a ton of dudes in the process, letting Paul and Lady Jessica escape. And this is a great action scene. We love to watch Duncan Idaho die.
Oh, yeah, and he'll be doing a lot of that soon enough.
I know. We get more Duncan, I think, in the second book. Is that right?
And all through the rest of he becomes like the main character for all the other books, like, or at least clones of himself or galas. Like, that's like, this is like being in the Dune, being Duncan Idaho in the Dune movies pretty much guarantees like he's going to be employed for the next like 10 years, like, as long as they're making Dune movies.
Hell yeah.
Like, there's going to be no shortage of work for Jason Momoa as long as he's
anyway. Like, that guy's money. That guy's a legitimate box office draw, I think. He's a good enough actor, but he's like, you know, he's hot. And he's got a size most people don't have.
He's the closest, we have to Arnold, basically. Like
Rock, I guess, you know.
Yeah, The Rock, not so much. I mean, Jason Momoa. Like, I always think The Rock is being, like, the replacement Arnold, but, like, I don't think he has the same draw or likability as Arnold does, because even, like, Arnold's stinkers are watchable. Like, you know, you have, like, you know, The Rock, you know, kind of shot himself in the foot, you know, doing, like, the whole Black Adam series. Sure. and so I think, like, he's kind of lost the mandate of heaven. Like, I do see, like, Jason Momoa kind of being a Arnold type guy, but because he does much more likable and takes on much more interesting roles, and
but
so Aquaman. I could see that, but he doesn't have the same like charisma as Arnold, yeah. though.
I mean, he's Aquaman though, which is that
he's Aquaman, Aquaman. Yeah. Which somehow was like $1 billion film. Like,
yeah, the first one was huge. I think the second one wasn't as big. It wasn't a bomb, but it was kind of a tanker, I think. I don't know. I don't
also think that's a result of also just like superhero
fatigue.
Yeah, fatigue. Like, no one wants to see cape shit anymore. It's I think it's run its course.
Fair. So some Harkonnens get the drop on Dr. Keynes, and she summons a sandworm to eat everybody, including her, which is really fucking sick. Paul and Jessica get to their dragonfly helicopter, which I think they call ornithopters or something. Mm-hmm. And they get chased into a storm.
And I love the ornithopters because, like, they're pretty much how they were described in the books. And also, like, I when this movie came out, there were reviewers saying, like, that was, like, the most unbelievable part, that this, like, sort of, like, flying machine could exist. It's like, and for one, it's science fiction. Like, two, the whole design is based on a dragonfly.
Yeah,
which
dragonflies work in nature, so, you know.
Yeah, and dragonflies also do have the ability to fly in any direction. They're the only animal that can.
Oh, interesting.
And, yeah, so that makes sense to design a flying ship based on a dragonfly, you know. So I think it's great, and I think it also like is kind of just like reflected of the world they live in, which is like more functionality than than a lot of like other sci-fi shit.
Absolutely. So next we get a scene between Rabban. Is it Rabban or Rabban?
Beast Rabban.
Rabban, okay, yeah. The Batista character. And of a Baron Harkonnen again, where the Baron is in, like, this pudding goo bath, and it's, like, this amazing set piece, and it's disgusting. It looks like he's like, bathing in a, like, a yogurt parfait or something.
Yeah, and I do like how it's, like, in the 1984 Dune, it shows, like, after he pulls, like, after Baron Harkonnen pulls a slave's heart plug and kills him. Mm-hmm. Like, he bathes himself in goo. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, that's supposed to be a very disgusting scene. Yeah, this is more of a goo scene, like a true goo.
Oh, it's like true goo. It's so fucking gooey, baby. He's, like, just bathing in semen and sweat. It's so good.
Yeah. And the goo is somehow life-giving. And I do like how it's just, like, it doesn't answer to us how it's saving his life or how he can breathe in that.
Yeah.
He just is. And it's just kind of like, you know, I like how it doesn't go through the links of trying to explain to the audience why that's beneficial to him. We just assume it is.
Right. Like, the only thing they actually really explain in this entire film is, like, the still suits. Other than that, it does not hold your hand. It just, like, shows you what's there and, like, lets, lets you decide about it. It's cool. Like,
which is sad because, like, you know, I mean, it doesn't even, like, I mean, I am sad, like, the series, you know, spoiler, doesn't show a guild navigator. Yeah. I guess it shows, like, kind of guild navigators in the beginning when, Duke Leto is delivered, like, the orders from the Emperor. Mm-hmm. And there's, like, kind of guys that are, like, you can kind of see they're encased in sort of, like, an orange smoke. Right. And they're presumed to be, like, you know, representative of the guild of the spacing guild. Mm-hmm. But we never actually see, like, a really deformed freaky, because, like, the guild navigators are guys who are, like, people who completely encase themselves in spice at all times.
Right.
And that's what gives them the ability to fold space without the aid of computers. And we don't get to see one, and I think that's, like,
I honestly think that's okay, because the guild navigators, as interesting as they are, like, the technical part of Dune that would turn a lot of normal people off.
Yeah, and it would, and also kind of, like, and obviously, like, the spacing guild is also pretty secretive themselves, so, like, it would make sense, like, they're not going to, like, there's no opportunity for any of our protagonists to actually, like, meet a guild navigator up close.
Right. And this is about, like, the politics of a resource.
Yeah.
Not the people who use it and why it's used really so much. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be like a film about the inner workings of the U.S. government when it's actually about oil, you know?
Yeah.
So,
I'm sure behind the scenes in America, we do have like some guy that's just like encased in oil 24/7.
It's just Cheney, I think.
Ah, yes, I have the powers of the CIA guild.
CIA guild. So Paul and Lady Jessica crash land in the desert and are found by the Fremen after almost getting eaten by a sandworm. And this is a really fucking cool scene where the sandworm like comes like right up to them and like kind of looks at them and then just goes away.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like, I think, part of the prophecy for like the Dune Messiah guy.
Yeah, the worm shows like some level of restraint, you know, and so it's just like, oh, could they, you know, be more than an animal? Do they have intelligence? Because it seems to be observing Paul, you mm-hmm. know, it's right. it's admiring his dark purpose, you mm-hmm. know.
Yeah,
it knows its future.
Oh, it's just like, damn, there ain't many twinks around here. How you doing, white boy?
What's up, space twink?
Yeah. You ever had a little worm in you? Do you want
you want a little worm in you?
We meet Zendaya, who plays Chani in this film, but we're going to call her Zendaya for this and Dune 2 because that sounds like a Dune name to me.
Yeah, she could have just gone by Zendaya, and that would have been fine.
Yeah, I would have bought it. Jemise, who is played by the wonderful Babs Olusen Mokun, mm-hmm. who we know as the chief medical officer Mbenga from mm-hmm. Star Trek: Strange New Worlds.
Yep.
Shout out to Soy Trek, our other podcast. Jemise challenges Paul to a battle, and Paul accepts. Paul's never killed anybody, but keeps on like getting the best of him. And finally, he like kind of summons the courage to kill him, and he ends up killing him. Interestingly, in the same way that someone kills a bull in a bullfight, mm-hmm. use like that same knife stroke to the spine.
Yeah.
Bringing back what you said, that mm-hmm. like, his grandfather was killed in the bullfight or whatever.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So Paul is brought with his mother into the Fremen fold. And that's the end of the first Dune movie from 2021.
Boom.
How do we feel about that film?
Yeah, I love it. Like, you know, we set up the idea that, yeah, we... Like the initial premise where it's like the Emperor is setting up the Atreides to fall because they're a popular house that has amassed a lot of power, mm-hmm. and it would be illegal in the eyes of just like how they of their empire to just mm-hmm. like kill him outright. But you know, if the Emperor were to like have like another person take him out, you know, in the dark, right. you know, on Arrakis, like right. he could wash his hands of it, and he's like, "Oh, I didn't make a martyr out of the Atreides,
right?"
Like,
but he uses his soldiers to help take over.
Right? Yeah, he used a couple Sardukar, but like, mm-hmm. but to help out the Harkonnens. But for the most part, like, yeah, the Emperor was trying to just do this and just kind of get away with it, have the Harkonnens take out his rivals, mm-hmm. and thus securing his like legacy, cuz the Emperor has only produced female heirs, and yeah. So it's like he won't have a successor, even though it's like it seems I feel like we're in need of like a, I don't know, a female emperor, an empress, if you will, but like, he was having like the Harkonnens take him out, and unfortunately, Paul survived.
Yeah, white boy survived.
White boy survived. White boy good with the sauce, you know. Right.
He's you know, a little quirked up, goated with the sauce.
This is a great job. Yeah, introducing all of like the different politics. And I do think it ends on a great way. You know, the first film was like this sort of like politics that are just completely almost, you know, alien to the Fremen themselves. Right. And so it's just like, and so Paul leaving that sort of world behind. He's no longer part of that. He's, in the eyes of the Empire, he is like dead. Like, anyway, like, he has no power anymore. Uh-huh. And so now it's, now the second film will be his existence with the Fremen and uh-huh. existing in the, living as the Fremen do and amassing power that way.
Yeah.
He's no longer Atreides from this point.
Indeed. I really, really enjoyed this film. I think I gave it like a 4 out of 5 stars when I saw it. Maybe 4.5. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think together with the second film, like, I'd rate the two of them together 4.5, mm-hmm. definitely. They're just quality films.
Quality films. Yeah, great, like,
great acting, great effects, great music, great editing, great cinematography. Just, I can't say enough good things about these films. They're pretty well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I you could tell it's like a labor of love. Mm-hmm. Like, Denis, like, obviously cared about the subject material and wanted to do an actual film, you know, with, like, you know, a lot of care and quality and attention. And I think he did it. Like, he obviously understood the subject material, mm-hmm. and adapted the best way he could.
I also think he adapted it the best way he could to bring in outsiders and people who are not interested in Dune into Dune.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that, you know, that does kind of alienate freaks like me who just want to see a damn guild navigator.
Yeah. You watch the whole film about the weird ass guild navigator, the one from June 1984.
I would.
Boy.
Yeah. I love that weird little freak. And I just want more of that weird little freak.
Yeah. We love our weird little freaks, don't we, folks?
Mm hmm.
Well, we've gone over an hour on this one, so I think we're going to go ahead and split this into 2 podcasts.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So, we're going to leave that one here, and, I'd recommend this film. Would you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think I haven't rated it on Letterboxd, but I would definitely give it 4.5 stars. I mean, as I said, I watched it 5 times when it first came out, and I'll watch it again and again and again.
I don't know if I've ever watched a film 5 times in a row, like, when it came out. That's nuts, dude.
Oh, shit. Yeah, I'm kind of... I mean, I think I saw Fury Road 5 times in theaters.
That's fair. That's a film you see 5 times in theaters, man.
Okay. Yeah, that rocked.
All right. Yeah, I guess that's been the Media Dungeon. Check out our Patreon at patreon.com/dumbidiotbs. You got anything else to say, Patrick?
No, I'm good.
Cool. I've been Britton.
And I've been Pat.
This has been the Media Dungeon. Thanks for hanging with us, folks.
Goodbye.
Cool.